Last week I had given you an outline, those who had been here last week, and for this week we remain with the Jewish Trinity of God, Torah, and Israel. During the week, I came across an article in a periodical called Christianity Today. I don't know where this stands as far as its liberality or right wing or wherever it stands, but I found something which seemed to be a good jumping off point for a discussion of the Jewish Trinity of God, Torah, and Israel in terms of a poll which was taken of Protestant ministers asking six questions, and those of you who maybe have seen this, it's the most recent, I guess, issue of Christianity Today, October 13th, will be able to, I only took three of the questions, although I could have taken the other three. I'd rather save more time for your questions. But I have decided to utilize these as a more concrete manner of going into details which are really so involved that it's difficult in one, two, or even more sessions to give a true understanding of it. Now, what I did was to copy down three of the questions. The first one was, I accept Jesus' physical resurrection as an objective historical fact in the same sense that Lincoln's physical death was a historical fact. Then they have church groups. They have six church groups, but I didn't bother to take the six. I just took the extreme left. It probably is not a leftist church, but among those that they took, this had seemed to have the most, let's say the more liberal leanings, and I took the most right-wing leanings and an average of the two middle ones, sort of. And so in the first question, you would see that the right-wing church had 93% of its ministers answering the question in the affirmative. I accept Jesus is the resurrection as an objective fact. The middle 66%, and the most liberal group 49%. Now, I bring this one because I think it's very important for understanding talking about God in the Jewish tradition. I bring it as an example of the fact that when we are talking about our theology in the Jewish tradition, we're talking in a kind of different dimension. We couldn't have a question like this. And our percentages for the question we could have would reflect this. What do I mean by that? God in the Jewish tradition is other. And anything that involves God cannot be something which would be like man. And therefore, you couldn't make a comparison or an analogy with a physical mortal incident or event, such as Lincoln's physical death, and comparing the two in a theological sense, Jesus' physical resurrection, because in the Jewish tradition, the whole subject of God is one where there is no kind of comparative category. Therefore, if we assume that this is our question of theology, we immediately come into a problem that the Christian is going to have a problem understanding a Jewish concept of God from the very beginning because of his being able to accept certain concepts about Jesus which would not be part of the Jewish tradition. Now, what happens in the Jewish tradition and in terms of trying to understand Orthodox conservative reform, we would have to say that throughout Jewish history, there have been two strains of thought. There's been a more humanist strain, which is more anthropocentric, and a more theocentric, with God more as the center. But the whole question about God has been dealt with rather than in terms of statements about God, have been dealt with in terms of God's actions. So that we don't have, either in all our literature, we might list it as follows: holiness,
I put to vote the prophet, the writer, the later rabbinic work, the oral law, as Mishnah, Talmud, and so forth. We do not find here any kind of catechism, any kind of dogma, where you have to accept a certain statement about God, and if you don't accept this statement, then you find yourself out of the tradition in one way or another. There have been those throughout history, even before the conservative movement came into being, even before the reform movement came into being, those who took more humanistic approaches and those who took more theocentric approaches, and most of the talk about God is in form of the parable or in the Hebrew, the Midrash. The Midrash, the allegories, the stories, the... Now, so within the traditional writings, let's say of the oral law, you will find many stories about what God does. But there's a statement that you are not bound by these different stories. If one happens to appeal to you more through its poetry than another, then that is acceptable, and you can just take that. The only thing you're bound by is God's law, which we'll come to in a few moments. So, reviewing this very briefly, one, the difficulty of the Christian and the Jew talking about theological problems because of certain underlying premises. Two, the fact that Judaism has never really had a kind of catechism or dogma about God, which had to be accepted by everybody, even within the tradition. Three, a general kind of flexibility and flowingness of theology in terms of midrash rather than in terms of doctrine. Therefore, let's take a theological issue about God and say that if you were to refer to the left and the fourth, the right and the left are to the middle of the conservatives, we might say that in today's society, of those who would be more fundamentally theocentric, you'll find them, of course, more in the right wing or in the Orthodox wing. But the number would not hit 93%. It would be much less, because you can be an Orthodox Jew and not be as theocentric as the 93% would represent here. Therefore, the numbers in terms of putting a theological fact and saying, do you believe this? Do you feel that this is necessary to accept to be a Jew theologically? There would not be such a high percentage in any of these three categories of saying, yes, we must accept this and this in order to be a Jew. However, there will be a good percentage of fundamentalists here. I'm going to leave open for questions. I'm sure there will be many questions on this area. I'm going to rush on now to another problem also involved in theology, the virgin birth of Jesus' biological miracle. Here again, you see a difference if you go from left to right. Well, again, based on the same kind of principle, back in the days of Rabbi Akiva, I mentioned last week, and when I talk about the rabbis, I'm talking about the oral law. Whenever I mention a rabbi's name, this is in the area of the oral law. Well, I mentioned last week about Hillel and Shammai. There were usually two schools of thought in each generation. Well, here we have a school of thought between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yismael. Rabbi Akiva was what we might consider an Orthodox Jew, a good Jew. I could say he was a conservative Jew, a good Jew. Rabbi Yismael was also an Orthodox Jew, a good Jew, a conservative Jew, a good Jew. Now, but Rabbi Akiva was a romanticist, and Rabbi Yismael was more of a rationalist. And this was 2,000 years ago. And so Rabbi Akiva sought to expand God's activities in the universe. And so he said, and we read this in our Passover Haggadah, he said, when God took the Jews out of Egypt, he didn't send down 10 plagues, he sent down 50 plagues. And he tries to show how he proved this in terms of reading the verses out in a certain way. He wanted to increase God's activity in terms of his relationship with the people of Israel and of the world. Rabbi Yismael did not see this as being a necessity in terms of Judaism. And he even went to another extreme, and he said, where it says in the Torah that God sent the man, the manna, down from the heavens to feed the people in the wilderness, it really doesn't say God sent the manna down. If you read the verse carefully enough, you'll see it says that God showed the people where the manna was growing. Now, this is 2,000 years ago, reflecting a kind of division of opinion based upon personality and understanding and so forth within what an Orthodox Jew would consider two very good, I mean, they couldn't do any wrong. Therefore, this leaves a great deal of interpretation again, even in the right religion, for discussions of miracles, for discussions again in the category of theology. And so again, the percentages would be looked at. And we go to definitely would say that the miracle was a miracle in the sense that we're talking about in the vision here, biological miracle, in that kind of sense. Of course, in all humility, I'm not sure that I really understand all the true extent of what these things mean, but in a superficial manner, I'm assuming that I have a general idea of the more fundamentalist approach, which is taken by 95% in the biological miracle and 40% only in the more liberal group. Therefore, again, as I say, we have this kind of area where the conservative Jews would be also in the middle theologically here, but again, the numbers would be much less going all the way down the line. Now, part three brings us to a question of Jewish law. Now, I believe in literal and really literal difference in the Bible. This one is much easier to deal with, them because the percentages are almost completely different. We had a group of Jews who believed in literal interpretation of the Bible, and they had a name which meant the literalist. And they were called the Torah. It comes from the word Mitzvah. Now, if we're going to ask somebody, I believe in literal interpretation of the Bible, how many Jews in the world believe in this literalist? Well, they would just be the Torahites. Now, the Torahites number maybe a few thousand in all the world. So even the most extreme Orthodox Jew who is not a Torahite would have to say no. Because Jewish law has always been based on the premise of the validity of the oral law of the rabbis. And therefore, the interpretation of the law is built in even in the most extreme of the Orthodox Jews. And so, we might get about almost a zero to the left extreme. And we might get, well, for some fundamental, but this would be an area which would be most clear in showing a difference in terms of the Jewish group. And again, I'm speaking a lot about Judaism in general and just giving you a picture of conservative in the middle, because conservative Judaism is authentic Judaism to the conservative Jew. And therefore, that's why I'm not mentioning conservative so much. Now, getting into this a little more, and I'm going very fast because I really do feel that the question period is usually the most fruitful because it's answering things that you really have on your mind. But getting into this, we have to say that within the only difference here between the Orthodox conservative Jew in terms of their understanding of the literalness of the law is that the Orthodox Jew has made the oral law into this. So therefore, if you ask the question, I believe the literal and interpretation of the oral law as codified finally in the 15th century, then you get these types of sentences among the Orthodox. If you can't touch the law, you have to be very careful. Meaning not the Bible law, but the law as it finally ended up in the what I mentioned last week in the solidified period. The conservative would be in a much lower category. The conservative movement says that the oral law also is certainly, if the Bible is open to an interpretation, then the oral law also is certainly open to an interpretation. And therefore, the conservative movement, and based on a question that was asked last week about authority and such, the conservative movement has a law committee of rabbis, of its greatest scholars, and when problems of Jewish law come up, they feel that they have the same authority to make changes that was the same authority that was in the hands of those who lived in the time of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel, or Hillel and Shammai, and so forth. And there have been a number of areas where they have made these changes. There's been a problem about marriage and divorce, and the conservative movement has come out with a marriage contract which stipulates within the contract that if there's a question of divorce, the couple has to come to the seminary for guidance, for counseling. This is for a number of reasons, which I won't go into completely, but the Orthodox have completely rejected this. And why? Because it's a change from the literal acceptance of the Orient. This marriage contract is not even mentioned in the Bible. It was a later edition of the rabbis. But the Orthodox rabbis refuse to accept any kind of change in terms of anything in the tradition, whereas the conservatives are basing their whole concept on what is known as positive historical Judaism. And positive historical Judaism evolved. And that we are not observing the same kind of Torah that Abraham observed, or that Moses observed, or that even Hillel observed, and that each generation must, within the framework of the law, the way Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Hillel and so forth made their changes, not by abrogating the law, either the written or the law, but to take the same mechanism that was used in the past and to once again make those kinds of changes which are necessary for the community. Now, there is one question which is missing from this list of questions, understandably so, and that is the question about the people Israel, meaning I said a very few words about God, a very few words about Torah, and now I say a few words about the people Israel. Now, there is no question here about the people Israel or the people Christianity, if there could be such a concept, but a Jew, if he were a Jewish minister, if he were to answer a poll like this, the poll maker understanding Judaism would be interested in finding out, well, what is your opinion about the Jewish people and your connection to it and what part it must play in the Jewish religion tradition. Now, if those of you who had the outline last week, remember that I used the term Catholic Israel. Now, Catholic Israel means universal Israel. And the basic premise is this. I'm not sure whether this would be the basic premise of Christianity, but you might say that the individual can find his salvation in terms of his relationship with the cosmos. What part the church must play is a question, I guess, depends upon which church group you're talking about. In the Jewish tradition, there is the sense, the understanding, that a Jew cannot find his salvation as an individual. He can only find it in terms of the community, both as an individual and as a member of the community. Therefore, it is built into our tradition that a Jew needs the community. Now, if he needs the community, for instance, there are many prayers in a service which cannot be recited by an individual alone, but there must be what is known as a minyan, or 10 men, because the Jew is not able, so to speak. Sometimes you talk about an intermediary between man and God. Well, you might say that in Judaism, Catholic Israel is the intermediary between man and God. And this is the means by which the individual can come into terms with the cosmos. Now, there are many, many aspects of this in terms of the fact that the Jewish, that the Bible starts off in the story of Abraham with a family and sort of like relations and descendants. And this family is going to be bringing the word of God into the world. This has been carried over through the tradition, through the laws which make us dependent upon the rest of Israel, between the laws which make us very sensitive to Israel. And you see, most of our theology comes out in parables. So you might say the theology of the people Israel would come out in a parable such as this, when the rabbi was offered to go to heaven. Or maybe even in the story of Moses. Like, I mean, there are a number of examples of this. Moses is about to die. Moses says, Lord, I don't want to die. And the Lord answers and says, well, you really have been such a great fellow that, I mean, I think that I should give in to anything you ask. So, you know, you don't want to die, all right? You don't have to die. The only thing is that it would mean my changing the whole order of the universe and the people of the world, sort of something would have to happen to them in order for you to go on living forever. And then Moses said, oh, well, then I can't do that. I mean, I can't just think of myself. Now, in another story, it would be the story of the rabbi who was told that he can go up to heaven And then he asks where some of his friends are going, and these may be Christian stories too, I don't know. And he hears that they're all in hell. In fact, all Israel is in hell, and he's going to be the only non-Jew up in heaven. And he said, oh, I'd rather go to hell. I mean, now this is a kind of humorous application of a kind of understanding that the individual has that he has to be with the people Israel in life and in death. Now, the people Israel also leads us to the next, and I really know I'm rushing through terribly, but it leads us to the next question, which is that of the land of Israel and the state of Israel. The Jewish people, as a people, has existed in the diaspora and can lead a very full life in the diaspora, but at the same time always has had a connection with the land of Israel. And I think this is probably one of the most difficult things for the Christian to understand, just as some of the Christian concepts, some are more difficult and some are less difficult for a Jew to understand. But this certainly must be very, very difficult for a Christian to understand. And it was manifest by the fact that last June, in the wake of the crisis in Israel, and without going into it too much, there seemed to have arisen some kind of problem in Jewish-Christian dialogue and relationship, because for one reason or another, the Christian was not able to comprehend what this meant for the Jew, that the Jews might be exterminated or the land might be taken over by the Arabs. Now, again, this would call for a number of lectures in terms of its full meaning, but the fact is that from biblical times, from the first commandment to Abraham, Lech lecha me'artecha, get out of thy land and go to a land which I shall show you, from that very first commandment, through the going back from Egypt to the promised land, this is probably known to you, but the prophetic understanding that even though the Jews would be punished for their sins, they would return, they would be returned to the land. The very fact that there are many laws in Jewish, what is known as halacha, in the Jewish law, which are dependent upon living in the land of Israel. If you live outside of the land of Israel, you can't observe these laws. So a religious Jew, if he really is sincere and honest and authentic, would have to agree that he is somewhat sinning by not living in the land of Israel. Now, the question of the state of Israel is another question, meaning the political power of a Jewish government within Israel is a matter which I think much more comes out of the 2,000 years of persecution and the fact that there was just, after World War II, no place for the Jew to go. Before World War II, none of the countries were willing to open their doors to the Jews, and so I think it just became out of a practical need that, well, if there are going to be persecutions against the Jews, there are going to be pogroms and such, there has to be one place where a Jew can be assured of finding refuge. And it seems in our kind of world today, it's only when you have the power of the government and make the laws that you can determine whether the Jews shall be allowed in or not, and so therefore you worry about having a Jewish government in one part of the world. But whether the Jewish, if the world would lose all its anti-Semitism, then there might not be any need for the Jews to have a political government run by Jews or a state of Israel, but they still would have to live on the land of Israel in order to observe the full breadth and width of all the commandments in the tradition. Therefore, once again, in a brief review, God in the Jewish tradition is an underlying premise and foundation for the whole tradition. However, how we understand God's position may be best gauged again by a parable when we say in our prayers, Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And the rabbis ask, why doesn't it say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Why does it repeat God three times? And the answer that one of the rabbis give is because the God of Abraham was not exactly like the God of Isaac, and the God of Isaac is not exactly like the God of Jacob. But each individual has a certain kind of attachment, connection with God, which will be different somewhat from the other, and that there really are very few areas where you could put down as a dogma and say you have to accept it. But an underlying acceptance of God certainly goes through all the religious groups, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, with the Orthodox today perhaps taking, in trying to shield themselves, maybe becoming a little more dogmatic than they would be if they weren't pushed against the wall by other factors. Number two, Torah. Torah, there is no Jew in the mainstream of Judaism who could say that the Bible itself must be accepted literally. The Orthodox Jew tends to say that the oral law as codified by the 15th century must be accepted literally. And of course, to a conservative Jew, this is a little absurd. And the conservative Jew would assume that what the rabbis did 2,000 years ago and 1,000 years ago, they can do again today. And if they don't do it again today, we're going to lose the Jews. Because if we're going to live the way the Orthodox want us to live, then the new generation coming up will not be able to stand up to Judaism. And the fact is that there are less and less Orthodox Jews and more conservative Jews in the system. The third element, and the authority again is in the hands of the scholars and the rabbis, and the third element is Catholic Israel, the people of Israel, being a concept of the need for this intermediary of the people Israel. Also, in essence, you might say one other factor here, that the law is considered somewhat to be in the hands of Israel as a people too. Sometimes, I don't know whether this is true or not, but in the Catholic Church, I get a feeling that more and more Catholics are using birth control measures, and that it's getting out of hand somewhat. Now, this is not just a problem which maybe the Catholic Church has, but this is a problem that the Jews have had in many centuries in terms of the law. And at a certain point, when the rabbis see something getting out of hand, they face up to it and they take it. And so once a rabbi was asked what the law is, he said, go out and see what the people are doing, and you know what the law is. This is also part of Catholic Israel, in the sense of Catholic Israel. And the state of Israel, the land of Israel, again, very complicated issues and such, but part of our connection with history and our connection that would be in the past and our connection in the present today with our attachment and our worry and our concern for the Jews all over the world. In conclusion, let me say that the conservative movement has problems and it has made great strides. Problems, very simply, one, most conservative Jews are not conservative. I have a synagogue as a conservative rabbi. Most of the Jews who come into my congregation could probably be more easily typified as being Reformed. They don't accept so much the law as the rabbi would like them to accept. They wouldn't want to go into a Reformed synagogue because it's too foreign to them to come into a synagogue without a head covering. But on the other hand, in most of their daily living and activity, they don't observe much more than the Reformed Jew observes. Secondly, the conservative movement itself is somewhat stifled because of its of many pressures put on it. And so there are many areas where they have not gone far enough in terms of confronting the problems of the day and making changes in the law which really need to be changed. They're treading very lightly in making any change, even though they accept the basic premise that change is possible. The great strides of the conservative movement certainly involve the fact that the conservative movement has done more than any other of the movements in terms of coming to grips with the problems of the great mass migration at the end of the last century, of taking these Jews and giving them a place in Jewish society. The conservative movement is responsible not only for education of its own people, it's having education of inter-clergy activities. It's been responsible for this very important program that's been on for many years on radio and television, The Eternal Life. It takes a view outside to the world as well as inside to itself. The conservative movement is responsible for the organization of a group of Hebrew-speaking camps, which now, during the summertime, you can find almost 3,000 young teenage, a little lower age too, youngsters studying during the summer and speaking only Hebrew and living a full Jewish life as a conservative Jew should be living, not as he would live at home with his parents who, as I say, aren't really that observant. The conservative movement has been very instrumental in a connection with the state of Israel, with Israel, because of some of the sociological factors which I spoke about last week in terms of the Reform at the beginning not wanting to get involved with another, with Israel, or maybe feeling that they didn't want to be suspect on the part of their non-Jewish neighbors. The Orthodox, many of them, were just not activists enough. Or some of them in the fundamentalist scene said, we can't do anything, we can only wait till God comes and makes a decision for us about it. And in that area, too, the conservative movement has made great strides in terms of bringing Israel into the life of the Jewish people here. I would say, finally, that the best, maybe the best accomplished, the greatest accomplishment of the conservative movement in Judaism is the following, based on a little poem I once found, not written by a Jew, and it goes like this. I met a little elfman once, down where the lilies blow. I asked him why he was so small and why he did not grow. He slightly frowned and with his eyes.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here today. Perhaps we should also introduce Mr. Newmark, Mr. Melvin Newmark, who is the chairman of the executive board of the regional board of the Anti-Defamation League. Mr. Newmark belongs to the United Hebrew Congregation, which was one of our is one of our sister reform temples. Of course, we'll forgive him for that, but he's been very active in the the B'nai B'rith as well as a number of Jewish community organizations. Mel was very kind to tell me just now that Rabbi Asher had discussed 19th century religious trends within Judaism, because this is what I was going to spend most of the day speaking about. So Mel, old buddy, I told him that he might have to... Oh, from the conservative point of view. Well, really, from a chronological point of view, Mel, you should have had Rabbi Boro, who was Orthodox, then myself, and then Rabbi Asher, since the conservative movement is newer. But since Mel is a Reform Jew himself, I think he wanted to save the time for rebuttal for a Reform rabbi, so he did it in a slightly sneaky manner. We really consider, many Reform rabbis really consider conservative Judaism as a form of liberal Judaism, feeling that there is the Orthodox denomination within Judaism and the liberal group, which would consist of the conservative and the Reform Jews. But I speak today specifically of Reform Judaism as a movement. And in order to understand what I'll say, you probably have to keep in mind the last two lecturers and their views of history. In the fact sheet that I received from Mel on this series, on Jews and Judaism in America, he asked that one of the things we discussed be the origins of the movement and how it came to be. Well, we as Reformed Jews view the Jewish tradition, Jewish history, all of Judaism, as a process of reform, as an evolving religion. Therefore, when Rabbi Boro probably came in and spoke of the Torah as being the south of our faith, the Pentateuch, that believing in a divinely revealed Torah, that from this comes the rest of the Hebrew scriptures, which we call the Old Testament, and then following this, all of Jewish literature, which the Orthodox Jew considers sacred, the Talmud and the Code, and all the way down, the Orthodox Jew believes, as I imagine he told you, that these directly grow from the revelation at Sinai, believing in the revelation at Sinai as a literal event, and believing in the binding necessity of the Torah and the laws that develop from it. We in Reform Judaism take what we like to call what our German founders called the scientific view. This is, we talk of scientific biblical criticism, and Mel didn't mention that my undergraduate degree is in biology, so I have to laugh sometimes when we talk about scientific methods in such things as study of the history of literature. Our view as Reform Jews is that we accept a documentary hypothesis concerning scripture with reservations. We believe that scripture was an inspired document and not a directly revealed one. And then this, therefore, would be a basic break with the view of Torah that an Orthodox Jew and many conservative Jews would hold. Therefore, we view all of Jewish tradition, all of our religious tradition, as a process of reform, of evolution, if you will, of evolution of the modern faith of Judaism. Therefore, we would say, for example, that probably most of us would date the
documents of the Pentateuch, what most modern scholars today, most of those who are adverse of the Grass-Wellhausen hypothesis, we would say that the prophets came along and reformed many of the laws that were before. We would say that the Book of Ruth, shall we say, was probably a propaganda document against the reforms of Ezra and Nehemiah. We would say that the Book of Esther was probably a satire disguised against the Assyrian Greeks. And we would go down the line saying that all of these documents have great influence, have great ideals, are a basic part of our faith, but we do not hold the basic tenets of the revelation at Sinai and therefore the infallibility of the Torah and all law coming from that. As one of the rabbis probably mentioned, the Hebrew terms were traditional law, halacha, 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 depending on your Hebrew pronunciation, was the basis of Orthodox practice. Let me just give one example of this. An Orthodox Jew believes that the rule in the Torah that you should rest on the Sabbath then was expounded by the rabbis in this tradition of revelation to mean that you should not ride on the Sabbath. Resting meant you should not ride on the Sabbath. Therefore, the Orthodox Jew today does not do any work and does not ride on the Sabbath. So therefore, a devout Orthodox Jew will locate himself within fairly reasonable walking distance of an Orthodox synagogue if he wants to follow his laws. Now, the Reform Jew, on the other hand, says, we want to get, quote, the famous radio show, back to the Bible, end of quote. And for us in the modern world, the idea of riding, of rest on the Sabbath, means riding on the Sabbath. If I live as I do 3 miles away from my synagogue, it's a heck of a lot easier for me on Sabbath morning and on Sabbath evening to get in my car, turn on the ignition, and ride down there than it is to walk. So we have a fundamental dichotomy in regard to Jewish law and Jewish tradition. The Orthodox Jew will follow these laws because he believes, one, they are of divinely revealed origin as developed through the literature of our people throughout the ages, and two, he will follow these because these are traditional. We Reform Jews do not accept the binding authority of the traditional Jewish halakha or law, and we do not accept the literal meaning of scripture. Now, with this very quick introduction, and most of our lecture and discussion next week will be aimed at this, what I just mentioned, let me give you a quick history of the founding of Reform Judaism. I neglected to ask, how long is the period? 120. And you'd like to leave some time for questions? Fine, good. Okay, I'll speak much more quickly. Rabbi Nadel, my senior colleague, had a 19-page sermon for the evening of Yom Kippur. We have two services on Yom Kippur. One starts at 7:15, and it's got to be out at 9:15 because 1,300 more people are coming in for a service beginning at 9:30. So I said to him, did you cut down your sermon? He said, well, it was so good that I couldn't cut out too much of it, but I'll speak fast. So that was, we just made it, believe me. Reform Judaism was an outgrowth of the ghetto experience of the Jew. And once again, here I'm going blind, and I hope that I'm not recapitulating what Rabbi Asher and Rabbi Boro mentioned. Up until medieval times, the Jews were allowed a fairly free hand in their own ritual and civil and religious law. That is, in the land of Israel up until the time of the destruction in the year 70, then in Babylonia up until the 10th, 11th, 12th century, then in some other countries such as Spain and Portugal under the Muslims. During this time, Jewish law grew and developed, and Jewish literature to some extent did, especially in Muslim Spain. Jewish philosophy did, Jewish poetry did, I should say Hebrew poetry, poetry in the Hebrew language. Many different areas within Jewish life grew. But in medieval Europe, when the Jew was ghettoized, there was, to a large extent, a cutoff. The Jew was cut off from the surrounding culture, and the Jew was cut off from many of the modern advancements that were taking place. Thus, he was completely cut off, shall we say, or almost completely cut off from the world of art, which really during most of this time was dominated by church art, and the major patrons were church patrons. He was cut off to a great extent from the development of modern music. One of my hobbies is Jewish music, and we're trying to see where there were examples of modern music before modern times, general music or church music affecting the ghetto Jew. There seems to be very little. The Jew was separated by a religio-economic anti-Semitism, and he was culturally cut off in some countries for many hundreds of years. Thus, his religion, which at this time could be called a type of Orthodox religion, became both a protective device, a morale builder, and an escape. By living his religion, well, in the first place, he couldn't escape from his religion because everyone in the ghetto was a devout Jew. Everyone was expected to pray three times a day in the synagogue. Everybody was expected to follow the dietary laws. And this was just a way of life. This was the surrounding culture. But there was very little room for creativity within Jewish law, and so they developed such schools as Tilpulism, T-I-L-P-U-L-I-S-M, Tilpulism. Tilpul was a method of studying the Talmud where you would find this section of the Talmud and then compare it to another section of the Talmud to look for the similarities and the differences. Well, this is not too creative. When you run out of creative possibilities, you start doing this type of work, unless you happen to be a statistician or somebody working in library science that needs this, or a research worker or something. So that the religion became a way of life that was very good for the Orthodox, for the ghetto Jew, for the Jew who needed this as a morale builder, as the only outlet really that he had culturally. He'd come home to the ghetto after a day's work and would then go to the synagogue where he could feel himself to be a real creature of God, one of God's chosen people, as he said, and there he would pray and study and have dignity in his eyes, and he thought in the eyes of God. So that Tilpulism, this type of hardening, this type of congealing religion, became the religion of the ghetto, and also there was much messianic speculation, belief that the Messiah would come soon. After all, things had become so bad, they couldn't get any worse, and this is what Jewish tradition had said would happen, so therefore many of the Jews at this time believed in the coming of the Messiah, that their sufferings were going to bring on the Messiah, and there is the old joke which probably symbolizes Jewish humor, the cynicism of it more than anything else. One person travels from one town to another, and as he enters the ghetto, he sees an old childhood friend of his sitting on the roof. And he says, "What are you doing up there sitting on the roof?" He says, "Well, I'm the person who's paid by the community to look for the Messiah." So his friend gives him a look that is to say, "What kind of job is that for a Jewish boy?" And that's what they usually ask us rabbis, "What kind of job is that for a Jewish boy?" And his friend gives him a look, so the man who's sitting on the roof says, "Well, it's not great pay, but at least I know I have job security." This cynicism of humor. Well, in the late 1700s, emancipation starts to arrive for the Jew. Lessing writes Nathan the Wise, in which he says that even Jews are human beings. In 1782, Emperor Joseph II of Austria issues a patent of tolerance which abolished the Jew tax and opened commerce and certain restricted occupations and schools to the Jews for the first time. A very seminal person within the history of liberal Judaism was Moses Mendelssohn. He was the grandfather, if I'm not mistaken, of the composer Felix. Moses Mendelssohn was what was known as a protected Jew in Germany. There were a few Jews who, by reason of their brilliance, were allowed to go to secular universities to get out of the Jewish area to live among Germans. And he became, as one author said, the lion of German society. He was a philosopher and a literateur, and soon he became a favorite of the Salon Society that met in the homes of the leaders of the German community. In 1763, he received the prize of the Berlin Academy, and it's interesting that one of the other people who were vying for this prize was a little-known philosopher by the name of Immanuel Kant. So Mendelssohn's paper won out, surprisingly enough, that he was a Jew. He was a staunch Jew. He was a very observant Jew, and he felt that he wanted to bring Jews into the modern world in Germany. He was, at one time or another, there are many apocryphal stories of how philosophers came to him and said to him, "We wish you'd convert and you wouldn't have all this trouble." And he said, "No, I'm a Jew and I want to remain a Jew." Well, he, in one great act, he really helped emancipate a German Jewry, and that was translating the Bible into German, but writing it in Hebrew characters. So he enabled the, I don't know whether Rabbi Asher mentioned this last week or not, he just emancipated German Jewry, because up until this time, most of them did not know German or the German language. They spoke a jargon of German and Hebrew called Yiddish. And if you can imagine, well, for instance, I guess the German word "ach," he would write like this, and then since all the Jews at that time supposedly knew the Torah so well, backwards and forwards, and most of the Bible, they were able to, one, learn most of the German language and become familiar with it, and Mendelssohn, through his efforts, was able to help bring German Jewry into the modern world. At this time, there were then two excesses within Judaism. From our point of view, Rabbi Borough wouldn't like me to hear me say this. What we consider two excesses within Judaism. On one hand, there were the so-called Salon Jews, this small group of Jews who had become very much assimilated, who many of whom then left Judaism completely. Moses Mendelssohn, who worked so hard to preserve Judaism by bringing most Jews into the modern world, saw both of his daughters marry Catholics and convert to Catholicism. And of course, Felix Mendelssohn, the composer, even though some people claim he was Jewish, had Christian parents and lived as a Christian. On the other hand, a group of Orthodox Jews, those who were used to ghetto life, wanted to retain this and solidified into a hardcore Orthodoxy. And we found these two very dissimilar groups, presuming to be the spokesmen for Judaism and the great masses of Jews, in the middle somewhere, sort of mixed up. How do you react when you're suddenly thrown into modern civilization in the late 1700s and the early 1800s? It's as if some of us had lived on possibly a Shaker community or an Amish community in Pennsylvania without any contact with the outside world for 200 years, and suddenly we're thrust into 1967. Many of the same problems happened to these ghetto Jews. In 1789, the French Revolution comes along. 2 years later, all the French Jews are emancipated. And we have a great ferment within Jewish circles. What are we going to do? How are we going to reconcile this ancient faith, which solidified to a great extent in the ghettos, with the modern world? And there were all different reactions. And the reactions are what we have as the three major branches of Judaism today. Now, most people say that Reform Judaism started with Israel Jacobson. And all of the Sunday schools remember Israel Jacobson because they're told that he came from Transylvania, where, of course, Dracula did. So we all remembered, many of us forgot Israel Jacobson's name, but we remembered from whence he came. Of course, from the Reform point of view, we say that Reform Judaism began with Abraham, knocking down his father's idols, as the Talmud tells us, and leaving to go to the land which God had promised him. But the start of, that's a little bit of propaganda, the start of the modern movement of Reform Judaism begins with Israel Jacobson, who lived from 1768 to 1828. And Jacobson was also a devout Jew who felt that what he called much of the dross which had grown up around the beautiful core of Judaism must be cleaned off. So he, who was a successful businessman, opened a boarding school. He called it a non-sectarian boarding school. Had mostly Jewish students there, since very few Jewish students were allowed in any other boarding school, so he wouldn't call it a Jewish boarding school, he called it a non-sectarian boarding school. In 1801 in Seaton in Germany, and he had a chapel there. We were discussing chapel services before. I mentioned that I often listened to the chapel services on the radio, because when I was at seminary in Cincinnati, usually the chapel hour, most of the guys were over at the mail room. So I figured maybe I could get my credits in now for a minute. He had a chapel there where they had Sabbath services. Now, if we remember that the Orthodox prayer service is entirely in Hebrew, is chanted, is very, very long, and therefore is chanted very rapidly, that the Torah and also the Haftorah, the prophetic portion for the Sabbath, is also chanted in Hebrew, that the men and women sit apart, that there is no instrumental music and no modern music as we have it, it's all entirely a chant, then we see that when Jacobson came along and started his liturgical reforms 150 years before Vatican II, we find the beginnings of what we could call the organized movement in Reform Judaism. Very quickly, he had some Sabbath prayers in German as well as Hebrew, prayer in the vernacular, and this was very shocking to the Orthodox authorities. For even though the Talmud said that you may pray in the language of the land, the tradition had grown up that God hears you best when you pray in Hebrew, and therefore you should pray only in Hebrew. He had singing of hymns in German and Hebrew, and some of these hymns were even in modern musical notation and sounded most likely a lot like the hymns that were sung in the Protestant church down the street. He abbreviated the services, cutting out many of the prayers that had grown up in later times and getting back to the core of the prayer service as it was in the temple in Jerusalem. He introduced an organ and also a choir which sang some of the responses in four-part harmony. The services soon attracted many Jews from the outside who had what we would call today the unchurched or the unsynagogued, I guess you'd call them, because they were not satisfied with the synagogue of their time. Later he opened a second school in Westphalia, also the scene of many famous vampires and ghouls. And there he established the ceremony of confirmation. Up until this time in Orthodox Judaism, only male children of the age of 13 could attain bar mitzvah, which time they were considered an adult member of the congregation. They came retisessi, of the Torah or Haftorah in Hebrew, proclaim their faith in Judaism. He established confirmation for boys and girls at a slightly older age, saying that in this modern world at 13 they weren't adults yet. So that Israel Jacobson becomes an important personage in the beginning of this. He makes a break with Orthodoxy. Well, in 1815 he is instrumental in starting services in Berlin that follow some of these reforms, and lo and behold, the Orthodox rabbinate, which is tied into the government through a chief rabbinate, which is an office that was officially recognized by the ruling powers, the Orthodox rabbinate went to the courts and said these reforms are going to destroy Judaism. They hit at the core of our worship services, and the government put an end to the reform services in Berlin. And then there comes, within European Judaism, a period of disagreement. Most Jewish communities in Europe, in fact throughout the world at that time, were set up on both a civil and a religious system, so that the Orthodox chief rabbi was the representative of the Jews to the government. And within the confines of Jewish civil law, if some disagreement occurred between two Jews and Jewish religious law, the government allowed the rabbi and his rabbinical court to have jurisdiction. Of course, if there were a dispute between a Jew and a Christian, it would go into the civil court. But there was a sense of Jewish community, of Jewish communal autonomy. And therefore, the Orthodox hierarchy, I shouldn't say hierarchy, the chief rabbi, could go to the government, and in some localities he was successful in getting these reform services ended. So that there were many disagreements, mostly in Germany, and this is interesting that our reform movement started in Germany also. There were many other liturgical changes. The first great break seemed to have come in terms of liturgy rather than in theology. Although in 1841, the Hamburg synagogue does eliminate all references to bodily resurrection and also to hope for the restoration of the temple and the restoration of the priesthood and therefore the restoration of animal sacrifices. Such prayers are still included in Orthodox prayer books, but the reformers in 1841 said that we no longer believe in bodily resurrection since this only came into Judaism during the Greek period and is not found, according to our tradition, in our Bible. That since we are a religious people and no longer a nation in exile, that we do not need to hope for the restoration of the temple in Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, one early Reform rabbi in America had a prayer in his prayer book that though we are sorry that the temple was destroyed and sorry about what happened to the people at that time, we yet give thanks that this enabled the faith of Judaism to become a universal faith rather than just a faith tied to the land. European reform was never a widely popular or greatly successful movement, but it did break the ice and it did lead to reform in many areas. Very quickly, one synagogue worship, I've mentioned many areas in which this has taken place, so that if you go into a modern reform temple today, we call our synagogue's temple to symbolize that we no longer mourn for the temple in Jerusalem. An Orthodox Jew would not call his synagogue a temple. If you go into, say, our synagogue, which is over opposite the University City Hall, you'd feel very much at home. It looks like a regular auditorium. The altar looks a little different. We have an organ and a mixed choir, and our prayer book is mostly in English with some of the prayers in Hebrew, and we have a sermon and a Bible reading and a closing hymn and things like this. And if it weren't for the words of the prayers, you would probably find it, and the melodies, et cetera, you'd probably find it not too different than many of your own services. However, if you would go into an Orthodox synagogue today, still you'd find the main reading stand in the middle of the room, the women separated on the sides or in a balcony, the prayer service much longer, all standing in Hebrew. European reform rejected the idea of a personal Messiah. European reform declared that women were equal in status to men. Therefore, we let the women sit with the men in the synagogue, and a woman in Reform Judaism can even be a president of a congregation or a rabbi, although we haven't had any women yet who have become rabbis. We had a couple who started out at the Hebrew Union College, and they always end up becoming Rebbetzins. That's a rabbi's wife. And they usually give up any ideas of studying for the rabbi, because I don't know of any rabbi who would like to say, I'd like you to meet my wife, the rabbi. So we haven't had any female rabbis yet, but Dr. Glick, our president, has said that he'd be glad to ordain them if some come around.